You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Share music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Somewhere north of north,
the far, far pole.
You are four times hotter, not so shiny, cold but warm, the cold shoulder, no place for me.
How it started and how it's going at COP30 Climate Conference in Brazil. We join a live presentation by Johan Johansson, Icelandic Minister for the Environment, Energy and Climate.
Welcome, Johan.
Thank you. Dear Excellencies, colleagues, there's a fire. Oh, whoa.
That's right. It feels like 100 degree heat, 37.7, in the Brazilian jungle. The climate conference caught fire. American climate author and activist Bill McKibben said, "People warned each other and evacuated. Firefighters arrived and used their tools to put out the blaze." In other words, everyone behaved in precisely the opposite way they've reacted to the fire that's begun to consume the earth. You and I, we're going to the opposite pole, where the cold isn't so cold anymore. Biologist Trond Christensen explains a gigantic light experiment is taking place in the Arctic. Sea ice retreat makes new marine environments. Meanwhile, cold-loving microbes go through a revolution of their own as the Arctic warms up fast. This tiny world affects everything. Could a rapid change in microbial worlds unbalance things like oxygen or greenhouse gases, change the clouds, threaten our own existence? From Montreal, scientist Scott Sugden reviews current and projected effects of climate change in cryosphere microbial ecosystems. Then we go back to Brazil, where we started. Despite the fire and a deluge of fossil fuel lobbyists, three experts reveal the latest worrying science on thawing permafrost, the carbon bomb of the North. From the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative at COP30, you hear selected clips from Gustav Hegelius, Stockholm University, Christina Schadel from Woodwell Climate Research Center, and Fabian Seaman, Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go to our first guest.
North of north, no south at all.
North of north,
at the pole, the far, far pole.
A gigantic light experiment is taking place in the Arctic, says a 2015 paper. Now we get an update with new science on the future of Arctic marine life, now that sea ice is in full retreat. Just published November 6th in Nature Communications, we are joined by lead author Trond Christensen. Trond's doctorate in biology comes from the University of Bergen. While publishing science, Trond advises on marine climate risk for Actia and the California nonprofit group Farallon Institute. From San Francisco, Trond Christensen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Alex, and thank you for having me.
We hear a lot about amplified warming in the Arctic. What makes it a light experiment?
Well, as many people know, the Arctic is a light-limited place, especially during the winter months. And with climate change, the seasonal sea ice cover that acts as a barrier for light to reach the ocean will decrease in extent and thickness. And when you have less ice, it means more light entering the water column, and that will have major consequences for the Arctic ecosystem.
In 2025, the Arctic sea ice maximum was the lowest ever recorded in the 47-year satellite record, but the rate of retreat has slowed. What do the latest coupled climate models predict for sea ice in the rest of this century?
The climate models agree that sea ice will continue to decrease in the future, and in some places ice will decrease faster than others. In our study, we find that the sea ice concentration in the Barents Sea will be drastically reduced by the end of the century, while in the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea, the loss is less dramatic. So that we're looking at both the Atlantic side of the Arctic and the Pacific side. However, for future predictions for sea ice extent varies depending on what future climate scenario you are considering. Different climate scenarios will project more or less sea ice depending on the projected overall warming associated with each scenario. So for our study, we considered two commonly used climate scenarios. To see shared socioeconomic pathways framework, we looked at the SSP 245, which represents one possible future where global development follows current trends. And it's sort of considered a middle-of-the-road scenario. And then we also consider the SSP 585, which is the fossil fuel development scenario, where you can assume that the future economic growth is powered by fossil fuel use, high energy usage, and technological advancements. And based on the SSP 245 for the Chukchi Sea in the Pacific, we find that annual sea ice concentrations may be reduced by half, while in the Barents Sea on the Atlantic side, we find that less than 10% of ice cover remains by 2100.
So will that lead to significantly more sunlight reaching the Arctic Sea in certain periods of the year?
Yes, as it will. When the sea ice becomes thinner and the snow on top of ice melts, more light is able to penetrate the ice and enter the water column. And typically, thick, pure sea ice covered with snow would reflect 96% of incoming shortwave radiation, while the reflection from melting and thinning sea ice is drastically reduced, leading to more light being able to enter the ocean. In our study, we found that for large marine ecosystems, so the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea, light can increase by as much as 75 to 160% by 2100, depending on what climate scenario you're considering.
That could be a doubling of light. Those are big numbers. Now, as you say in your study, you're looking at the Barents Sea and the Chukchi over Alaska. Why focus there rather than a survey of the complete Arctic Ocean?
Well, that's actually a great question, and you're motivating me to start a new project looking at the Central Arctic. But for this study, we focus on the edges of the Arctic Ocean, as these are highly productive waters with seasonal sea ice cover, and would be the first focus of new fisheries exploitations and the climate change. We also wanted to highlight how climate change, although a global phenomenon, may impact geographic regions differently. And finally, both the Northern Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea that we focus on are important waters for commercial fisheries of walleye pollock in the Pacific and Atlantic cod in the Atlantic side. And at the same time, these are also very critical habitats for Arctic cod.
The role of sea ice and more light might be counterbalanced by more clouds over the Arctic in a changing climate. What did you find there?
Well, for both the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea, the average cloud cover remains nearly constant over time period 1979 to 2100, which is the period we looked at. And the value stays around 82 to 87%, so there's very small variations. We did find an increase of 2% increase for the SSP 585 scenario in the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea. And this could probably be related to increased areas of open water and increased evaporation. Still, there are differences and uncertainties in the projections in cloud cover across climate models, and it would be interesting to look deeper into the driving mechanisms of this.
So this is something that puzzled me ever since I encountered your paper. Why would increased sunlight and warmer summer waters in the Arctic Ocean lead to reduced phytoplankton levels? You would think more light would be good for plankton.
Well, we're not really saying that the overall levels of phytoplankton will be reduced. We're just saying that the timing of the phytoplankton spring blooms will change. For example, we find that shorter sea ice season and more open water can trigger spring blooms once the ocean temperature and light conditions are optimal. And for both the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea, we find increased biological production during April and May, and we find reductions in July and August. And for the Northern Bering and Chukchi Sea, we also find indications of an onset of fall bloom in October.
But I thought there was a theory that better conditions would lead to massive phytoplankton blooms, but then they would use up limited nutrients available in the Arctic Sea before they could be replenished.
That's a possibility, absolutely. The problem when you're looking at phytoplankton production, using these climate models is that there's a huge uncertainty levels. The different climate models disagree with each other. One thing that they do sort of agree on is the changes in the timing of when events will take place. Whether that will actually lead to an increase or a decrease in phytoplankton production, the uncertainty levels there are quite high.
It's interesting you should say that, because I heard that from a Russian plankton scientist back in 2012. He said, we don't really know whether warming is going to be good or bad for them. So we're still in that spot. Your PhD involved polar cod, and in America those are called Arctic cod. Tell us about this strange fish, how they survive that harsh environment, and why does it matter how they do in these warming seas?
Polar cod is a very interesting species. It's a circumpolar species, meaning it's found continuously across both the Pacific and the Atlantic side of the Arctic Ocean. Small, light-colored cod fish that is uniquely adapted to the cold Arctic conditions with antifreeze proteins that actually prevent their blood from freezing. This fish feed on zooplankton and shrimp and represents a keystone species, a critical component of the Arctic food web, and provides an excellent source of food for seals, whales, and seabirds. Interestingly, Arctic cod typically lay their eggs under or near sea ice, where they are protected from breaking waves and UVB radiation in the surface layer. And once the eggs hatch, the larva can actually feed on the ice algae underneath the ice. And the survival of eggs is closely linked to temperature. And as the water is warm in the Arctic, the survival rates of their eggs drastically decline. When the temperature reaches 5 degrees Celsius, there's no survival. So you could think of the egg stage as being sort of a bottleneck stage for the species' survival. But because polar cod are found in Arctic environments, either under or associated with sea ice, there is a lot we do not know about these species, as they are hard to find and they're very infrequently observed. So, for example, for the Bering Sea, we typically only have observations during summertime, as the conditions are so rough during winter for making observations.
If polar cod use extra light to better hunt their prey, how do they live through long months of polar night?
Well, they likely reduce their metabolic demands during the darkest months when food is less abundant, though they remain active swimmers rather than entering through dormancy. Their antifreeze proteins allow them to remain active in sub-zero waters. They also build up lipid reserves during the productive spring and summer months that help sustain them through winter's leaner times. We observe polar cod spawn in vicinity to sea ice, but we also observe them in open water. So clearly these species can adapt and survive under different conditions, but we have limited amount of observations. I mean, we think that they would be more protected under sea ice with a higher chance of survival through the difficult early life stages.
Your team considers all kinds of factors determining whether solar energy reaches into the ocean or is reflected back towards space. And climate projections do show a more stormy future near the poles. How does that influence light in the sea and warming?
Arctic surface wind speeds are projected to increase substantially under climate change, with the most pronounced changes occurring during autumn and summer and winter. Stronger winds, increased waves, and the surface roughness of the ocean, and the tiny air bubbles that forms in waves, the white caps, they scatter and reflect more light compared to a flat surface. So we account for that in our modeling of light.
What I don't see in this paper is any link between heat and light. That is, more energy is moving into the sea because there is no sea ice. But how is that heating the ocean, yet increased light warms water? Can you sort out this confusion between heat and light for a non-scientist?
Well, the climate models do model incoming light into the ocean, and this is reflected in the modeled ocean temperature. As part of our study, we visualize how the shrinking sea ice concentration leading to more open water is accompanied by a strong increase in ocean temperature also. The change in ocean temperature is directly calculated from the flux of shortwave radiation into the ocean density, and the heat capacity of the ocean.
On land, we find brown bears from the boreal starting to arrive in the land of polar bears. Species move poleward with warming. What does your study find out about marine species moving north towards the Arctic?
Well, in our study, we discussed the potential for walleye pollock to expand northwards into the northern Bering and Chukchi Sea. However, such movements may also be limited to seasonal migrations because of the persistence of the winter sea ice. However, for the Barents Sea, it is only the northern waters where Atlantic cod may be limited by seasonal sea ice. And this northward movement is already happening, and surveys of pelagic fish, for example, in the Chukchi Sea between 2012 and 2019, found a drastic increase in walleye pollock abundance. They increased from 0.1% presence to 21% presence by 2019.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is biologist Trond Christensen. We are talking about the future of life in Arctic waters. In 2018, you co-authored a paper on the long cycle of cooling and warming in the North Atlantic called the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, or AMO. Where are we now in this 60 to 80 year long natural cycle, and could current Arctic warming be part of that?
Well, as far as I know, we are currently still in a warm phase of the AMO, and this phase is expected to last until around 2030. But we do know that the current warming of the Arctic far exceeds the amplitude of past AMO events, which underscores the role of human-driven warming of the Arctic. That said, the recent year's slowdown in the rate of sea ice loss could be linked to changes in the NAO and the AMO, where we go from negative phase in 2010 to a more positive phase now, which has led to reduced heat and moisture in the Arctic. There was also a very recent Nature Communications paper that dives into these details by Wang et al. 2025.
On Radio EcoShock, scientist Kevin Trenber suggested global warming may override even the strong cycle of El Nino and La Nina in the Pacific. Do you think climate change could alter or suppress the Atlantic multidecadal oscillation we just talked about?
That's a very difficult question to answer, and definitely on the edges of my research area. Perhaps climate change is more likely to fundamentally alter the AMO than to completely suppress it, primarily through changes to the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. However, there is also emerging scientific consensus that the traditionally called the AMO may itself be partly an artifact of external forcing rather than purely internal variability.
Your new paper hopes to improve prediction of future polar ecosystems. Is there a model specifically designed to forecast Arctic light changes and resulting marine warming? Should we have such a model?
Well, all of the global climate models, such as the CMIP-6 models coming from the coupled model intercomparison project, which is used by the IPCC, include calculations and projections of Arctic light and temperature. In these models, the change in temperature of the Arctic Ocean is directly affected by advection of warm water from the south, the atmosphere ocean heat flux, and the difference in temperature of the air and the ocean, and also incoming shortwave radiation that heats up the water column. The radiative transfer model that we created in the study we're talking about now takes the output from these climate models and use these output as input to calculate the spectrally resolved light that comes through the atmosphere and finally enters the ocean. And our model accounts for changes in sea ice thickness, snow concentration and thickness, and many other variables that affect the reflection and the absorption of light. And the benefit of utilizing our radiative transfer model is that you can actively explore how different wavelengths of light, such as the visible or the UV component of light, will change under different climate scenarios across a range of different climate models. This allows you to really explore the uncertainty levels in light calculations across a modeling portfolio.
This paper in Nature Communications puts prediction graphs for the IPCC intermediate scenario called SSP 2.5 to 4.5 right into the main paper. Results for the more alarming SSP 5 to 8.5 scenario are back in the supplementary materials. Some experts guessed, say, without a drastic change in human affairs, our current emissions is likely to reach higher warming. Tell us what your team found for the Arctic marine environment if that worst-case IPCC scenario arrives.
Yes. So we use the SSP 585 scenario to consider the worst case scenario or possible consequences of climate change for the Arctic Ocean. And what we found was alarming. We found that temperatures in the Chukchi Sea could increase by as much as 6.9 degrees Celsius during August or in summertime, up from today's average of 1.4 degrees. For the Barents Sea, we found similar strong increase in temperature of 6.8 degrees Celsius during summertime, compared to today's average of 3.3 degrees. We also see rapid decrease in sea ice for both of these regions, with annual average values ranging between 0 and 20%, which is basically a complete collapse of the sea ice. Such dramatic changes would have enormous impact on the food web structure of Arctic ecosystems.
Your models on photosynthetically active radiation showed a possible tipping point for the Arctic Ocean around Alaska. Please explain.
Well, we did observe a sudden significant increase in photosynthetic active radiation or visible light after 2050 for the SSP 585 scenario in the northern Bering and Chukchi Sea. And this could indicate that the system reached a tipping point, potentially caused by a complete collapse of sea ice concentration and a strong increase in air and ocean temperatures.
There's a back and forth between better and worse conditions for fish during coming warming. Overall, when you add it up, Trond, are we looking at diminished or better commercial fisheries in polar seas due to warming?
I do think that some boreal fish species like Atlantic cod and walleye pollock will benefit from warming waters as the temperatures get closer to their preferred temperatures. This could have potential benefits for new areas opening up to these species, and that, again, could open up to increased commercial fisheries in new regions. But it could also mean that areas further south have become less habitable due to the temperatures have become too high.
In years of interviews with scientists, the talk was more about sunlight heating the sea. No one explored the impact of more light. It's like someone turned on a light switch up there, illuminating a hidden world. What do you think about this gigantic light experiment?
I think the climate projections on severely decreased sea ice concentration and rapid warming in the future will potentially eradicate the Arctic ecosystem as we currently know them, unless we start reducing fossil fuel usage and reducing the impact of climate change. I'm still optimistic that the world will come around to make a real effort in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but we need to do more than what we're currently doing to avoid having the projected gigantic light experiment actually come true.
I know you have several projects on the go, from fisheries adaptation programs to more regional marine climate forecasts. Would you like to pick one to tell us about?
Well, I really enjoy projects that have real-world applications for communities or actors that are grappling with how resources may need to be managed differently under climate change. In one case, I have worked with local community to understand which species may move out of their allocated fishing area and which may move in. In another project, I'm trying to identify which aquaculture areas may be better suited for future climate conditions. I like trying to find ways to do innovative science that can also be useful for better management and stewardship of our ocean resources.
From San Francisco, we've been speaking with biologist and fisheries specialist Dr. Trond Christensen. He is lead author of the new paper, Climate Change Impacts on Ocean Light in Arctic Ecosystems. That is open access, free for anyone to read. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Trond, thank you for sharing your time and this science with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
It turns out life is everywhere. From glaciers to permafrost, strange species survive conditions even in the dark, well below freezing. Now microbial life in the ice world is changing Earth's climate as climate changes them. A team of scientists reviewed what is known. They just published the paper, Current and Projected Effects of Climate Change in Cryosphere Microbial Ecosystems. The lead author is Scott Sugden, a research scientist and lecturer at McGill University in Montreal. He joins us now. Scott Sugden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Was there a particular question that drove you and your colleagues to assess life in the coldest places?
You know, like you just mentioned, Earth has many cold temperature ecosystems, permafrost, glaciers, sea ice, and all of these ecosystems are really sensitive to warming. And so, you know, we kind of set out to ask this question, well, across all of these ecosystems, what are some of the general consistent truths that we see in terms of microbial responses to warming? And then where is their nuance? You know, where do we need to put an asterisk next to that truth and say, well, this is true most of the time, but in a few cases, it might be a little different.
Well, these little creatures that we cannot see colonize some seemingly impossible environments. Tell us about surprising places in the catalog of cold, hardy life.
It's truly amazing where these microorganisms are able to live and metabolize, you know, inside glacial ice, frozen environment. You know, you'd think there's a lot of water there because it's ice, but you know, most of that water is frozen, so it's not available for a cell to use. Similarly, in permafrost, so soil that's, you know, deep underground and frozen all year long, microorganisms are able to find these really, really thin veins of water that provide just enough to survive. There are ecosystems in the Arctic, in some of the places that we work, some springs that discharge water from deep underground. This water is significantly saltier than seawater, minus 5 degrees Celsius most of the time, and still microorganisms are able to live there.
What are the lowest temperatures where living things have been found, and how do they survive down there?
So lowest temperature that they've been found is tricky because microorganisms can often live or survive at lower temperatures than they're active. They can just go into kind of periods of dormancy. The same way an animal might hibernate through the winter, if it just gets a little bit too cold, a microorganism will shut down and wait for the right time. But microbial activity has been detected as low as minus 20, minus 25 degrees Celsius, active microbial activity. And a lot of what they do is they find these really thin veins of water that contain higher concentrations of salt. So high salt concentrations in water lowers the freezing point. And so even at, you know, minus 7, minus 8 degrees, if the water is salty enough or contains enough solutes, you'll have this thin vein of water that's preserved that allows these cells to live.
Scott, are there viruses in this frozen world? And what about the stories of ancient organisms that could cause disease emerging from long frozen stores?
There are viruses in these ecosystems. These viruses serve more of an ecological role. They're kind of the predators of the bacteria that live in these ecosystems. So we're not talking about viruses that, you know, might infect humans or cause human health issues. These are kind of important aspects of any microbial community.
Why do you say, quote, the trajectory of our warming world will be closely linked to microbial activity within the warming cryosphere?
That's a wonderful question, and it's one that has and continues to fascinate me. You know, all of these microorganisms that live in these really cold temperature environments, for the longest time, they've been really strongly limited by kind of two major things. One, they don't have a lot of food that they can use for their metabolism, or in the cases where there might be a lot of food available, that food is frozen, so they can't actually use it. So limitation number one, not much food. And then number two, these cold temperatures have really slowed down their metabolisms. It's the same as, you know, humans, when we get hypothermic, our metabolisms will slow down. At low temperatures, these bacterial metabolisms slow down. And that's been the truth for the past, you know, several hundred years. But now, with climate change, both of those limitations are going away. As these ecosystems thaw, more food becomes available. And that's not just temperature-driven, but more precipitation, more runoff will move nutrients around, make more food available. And then warming temperatures are accelerating these metabolisms. And so both of those things, when you think about them happening across a landscape as vast as the cryosphere, think of how much of the world is covered by permafrost, sea ice, glaciers. Think Antarctica in there as well, the Greenland ice sheet. even small upticks in microbial activity over such a large area are going to start to have some really profound consequences.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.